This is Morgan Michael, welcoming you to Kindsight 101, the podcast, where you'll hear from world-renowned educational leaders about the mobilizing power of kindness, together by challenging our assumptions and venturing beyond the status quo in education. We can make a big impact, one small act at a time.
To engage in learning is to feel incompetent momentarily. And then to go through learning means that you're going to come out the other side a different person. And what we have to do if we want to educate anybody is counter all of that negative tension with the positive tension of possibility. The possibility that this might open a door for you, the possibility that things will be better, the possibility that instead of being left behind, you will come out ahead. We can help people move forward.
In this very special episode, I talk to the one and only Seth Godin about disrupting the industrial model of education, helping students to get comfortable with the struggle of learning, and to venture beyond the pull of wanting to fit in. We also discuss the real purpose of school and how we can best prepare our students for the uncertain future. Finally, we explore the best way to provide feedback and advice to our learners so that they may become the fullest expressions of themselves. Seth Godin is the author of 18 books that have been bestsellers around the world and have been translated into more than 35 languages. He is also the founder of the Alt-MBA and Marketing Seminar, online workshops that have transformed the work of thousands of people. He writes about the post-industrial revolution, the way ideas spread, marketing, quitting, leadership, and most of all, changing everything. You might be familiar with his books, Lynchpin, Tribes, The Dip, and Purple Cow. In addition to writing and speaking, Seth has founded several companies, including Yoyodyne and Squidoo. His blog, which you can find by typing Seth into Google, is one of the most popular in the world. In 2018, he was inducted into the Marketing Hall of Fame. His latest book, What to Do When It's Your Turn, is now in its fifth printing. You can find it at yourturn.link. And his new book, This is Marketing, comes out in November of 2018. I hope you enjoy this conversation. Thank you for taking this call. I'm really, really excited for this interview, Seth.
It's a pleasure. It's good to talk to you.
So when people describe you, they tend to start with your accomplishments as a best-selling author, a blogger, a speaker, and a Hall of Fame marketer, because those lists of projects that you've done and your overall impact on the world is so impressive and unparalleled. But I've really come to see you first and foremost as a really gifted global scale educator. Through the work that you do, you've enabled your audience to see past the limitations that we might have. You encourage all of your listeners and your readers to think big and to think about our shared humanity. What does it mean to you to be an effective teacher?
What a great question. Thank you for thinking about this. What does it mean? Well, it used to be that there weren't books. But then there were books, but they were hard to find. But now there's the internet. And so if you want to look something up, you don't need a person to help you do that. Access to information is no longer a problem. There are people in little remote villages in Malawi who have access to the same information that you and I do. We get into a trap then if we think that the purpose of education is to give people access to information. It's not. And that is probably the biggest shift in our lifetime when it comes to education. So for me, education is about earning enrollment and then using that enrollment, which means someone is leaning in, they're eager to transform themselves, using that enrollment to create enough positive tension that people will move forward in a way that they wouldn't move forward if you hadn't been involved.
When you talk about positive tension, can you elaborate that a little bit so that people really get a clear idea of what that means?
Well, you know, it's interesting. If you watch what happens at an airplane, people are jostling to get on at the beginning. And then once it lands, they're jostling to get off. So what is it, on or off? Well, It turns out before the plane takes off, there's tension. The tension of, will I get a good seat? There's tension of, will I be able to put my bags away? There's tension of, I don't want to miss the flight. That tension is positive in the sense that if you're the airline, it's really an effective way to help you load the plane quickly. And the tension at the end is, I got to get off this thing. I've been on it for too long. I want to see my loved ones. And again, that's positive tension because the airline doesn't have to go sweep everybody off the plane. Mm-hmm. Well, there's negative tension as well. And that's the tension most of us associate. That's the tension of being stuck in a traffic jam when you're late to meet your friends. We don't get any benefit out of that tension. It's similar tension, but we don't get any benefit out of it. And so what we do when we're trying to make change happen is we have to acknowledge that change always causes tension. The tension of, this might not work, the tension of, I'll get in trouble, the tension of, I'm a fraud, the tension of, I'll waste my money, et cetera, et cetera. Mm. And the same thing's true with learning something. When we're about to learn something, it means we're momentarily going to be incompetent because we will discover that something exists that we don't know how to do. And until we discovered that existed, we felt competent. So to engage in learning is to feel incompetent momentarily. And then to go through learning means that you're going to come out the other side a different person, by every measure, a different person. But you might not like that person. Your friends might not like that person. You can't go back once you go through it. So there's tension there. And what we have to do if we want to educate anybody is counter all of that negative tension with the positive tension of possibility, the possibility that this might open a door for you, the possibility that things will be better, the possibility that instead of being left behind, you will come out ahead. And by amplifying those tensions, we can help people move forward.
Wow. Yeah, that, I mean, that sounds pretty incredible when it comes to our goals as educators, really. And within that vein, you know, as a society right now, we tend to want to inoculate our children from struggle. But in doing so, we can actually prevent them from experiencing the stuff that actually makes them resilient in life and makes them learn. So as educators, it can be hard to teach the important stuff, things like perseverance and problem solving. It's uncomfortable. You have kids crying on the floor sometimes. And so wanting to lean into that discomfort in terms of learning can be very, very challenging. And I think challenging also from a teacher standpoint. So what's your take on the dip as it relates to education, that resistance and that struggle from a teacher's standpoint, but also maybe from a student perspective?
Well, most teachers have a handicap that I don't, which is they work in a system. And the system is working against them. It's working really hard against them because it was built by industrialists who prize compliance over everything else. And that's why school was invented, to train people to become compliant factory workers. And so if you are working in a compliance-based system, I applaud you, but I also feel badly for you because your work is way harder. And the enrollment that I'm talking about is not just the enrollment of, do I have a student on my side? It's, do I have an administrator and a parent on my side? Because if you don't have that enrollment, it's going to be very hard to help people get through the dip, to get them across that chasm from I can't to I can. And so seeking enrollment early and often is the key. And if we look at successful charter schools like the Harlem Village Academy, it is only successful because they have enrollment from parents, teachers, and students. And if you don't have that, it's really hard to make a difference.
And you've talked about the purpose of education extensively in your manifesto and then also in your TED Talk, What is School For? And actually, a lot of that work has completely changed my personal approach to education. It has really made me seek out the discomfort in some respects because the promise of what's on the other side is really enticing. And I think that's kind of the beauty of real life learning, is that when we are able to push beyond that, that we, as you said, you become a different person. What needs to change in terms of our approach to the purpose of school? What do you think school is for?
Well, those are two questions. The first one is what needs to change is we need to ask the question, what is school for? Mm. We need to ask it at every school board meeting. We need to ask it at every PTA meeting. We need to ask it at every student-teacher conference. It makes absolutely no sense for me that we spend all of this time and all of this money, measured in years, without knowing why we're doing it. What's it for? If you don't know what's it for, how can you possibly come up with a decent answer? Mm. I have a what's it for, but my what's it for isn't necessarily the right one, but at least I have one. Mm-hmm. And I think the what's it for is two things. One, teach kids to solve interesting problems. And two, teach them to lead. Mm. So what makes something an interesting problem is it's something you can't look up in Wikipedia. And the reason we need to learn to solve interesting problems is that computers and people who get paid way less than us are going to take all the work solving the uninteresting problems. And the second part, to lead, well, once we have access to information, once we realize that all we're left with is the idea of organizing our culture and making life better for the people around us, the one thing they don't teach you in school is the one thing you need the most, which is the ability to lead other people.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And I think about that leadership piece. I think you do it so beautifully in a consistent way, year over year, day over day. And a lot of that, I'm starting to realize, comes from the way that we weave a story, the way that we engage people in a promising future. And so I'm always in awe of your ability to make these complex, really abstract ideas seem so attainable and concrete through your use of storytelling and analogy. And would you agree that storytelling is a really important key to effective leadership? And if so, why do you think that's the case?
Well, you're being very kind, but I've seen you in a classroom setting and you do it too. Lots of people do it, but you do it too. And so it's not this rare skill. It's simply a choice. Mm. And when I talk about storytelling, I'm not saying once upon a time and happily ever after. Stories are based on semiotics, the signals, the flags, the hints, the shorthand. So we begin there. And then we layer on top of that ideas and memes and concepts that people already know. We use analogies and similes and we say, this stuff you believe is a lot like this stuff you need to embrace. We just need to put one more component on top of it, right? So Pictionary is a lot like charades, but with paper. Mm. So with one sentence, I told you a story mm-hmm. that saved me reading you 20 pages of rules, right? And
yes.
So we teach each other that way all the time. But in the compliance-based model of education, we get to the classroom, we say, oh, no. Now we need a number two pencil and a standardized test.
And I think that's the part that really holds us back is this inability to kind of get enrollment in a really authentic way. And I know that the phrase, is this on the test, seems to be a guiding mantra for many students, teachers, businesses, even in some realms, and individuals. And many school districts care more about reading metrics and hard academic data than creating lifelong learners and fostering a sense of identity within their students. What should we be asking ourselves as we set out to teach math and literacy and content-rich subjects? How should we replace that phrase to make learning more meaningful?
Well, what is math for? If the purpose of math is to create mathematicians, then we're doing a really, really bad job of it. Because we only produce one mathematician out of every, 2,000 students. So why did we spend all those years with all those kids to create one mathematician? I don't think that's what math is for. Hmm. And if the purpose of math is to teach kids to do arithmetic in their head, again, I think we're failing because the vast amount of arithmetic that gets done isn't getting done in our head, and we don't need to do it in our head anymore. I think the purpose of math is to teach people to be really comfortable with abstract concepts and to be really comfortable moving from things in the real world to abstract variables and then back again. Mm. Well, if that's what we're teaching, let's change the curriculum and teach that.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So when I was running Yoyodyne, we were hiring sometimes a person a day. We were growing very fast. Mm-hmm. And the way I shifted our hiring was I took a full page ad out in the New York Times and I invited people to an open house, and 500 people came. We did three shifts. And at the end of the open house, where I gave the talk I would have given every single person in the job interview, I just did it all at once.
Mm-hmm.
We had them sit at tables of six or eight people with a couple of our employees at each table, and got to a sense of how they interacted with each other, because that's what you do at work, right?
Yes.
And then we asked the following question. So working together or alone, whatever is better for you, and there were no smartphones in those days, so we didn't have to worry about this part. We said, tell us how many gas stations there are in the United States. And we really care about how you do your work. Go. Now, I'm guessing you're not in the United States, but we have gas stations here like you have gas stations in Canada.
Yes.
And it was a stunning thing to watch because it always went the same way. So there were six people at the table who were interviewing. And what always happened is this. Two or three people said nothing but took notes.
Huh.
One or two people criticized from the very beginning, saying to whatever anybody said, try something else. And one or two people took the lead. Now, among the one or two people who took the lead, every once in a while, someone would say, well, there are 50 states. This is dumb. It's dumb to start with there are 50 states. That adds no information whatsoever to the question of how many gas stations there are in the United States, because Wyoming has nothing in common with California. So who cares that there are 50 states?
Hmm.
But every once in a while, someone would start down a path. Then they'd realize they were at a dead end, turn around and go down a different path. And they'd go in a circle. And within 2 or 3 minutes, they were onto something. And then they would start calling on people in the group and say, all right, work on this little subset, work on this.
Mm-hmm.
And within 4 minutes, they had an approach.
Mm.
And out of every 100 people who did it, I would get a letter with a stamp the next day or the day after with the right answer in it, as if I cared how many gas stations. But the point is, the last group that I told you about, the people who were leading,
mm-hmm.
we hired them.
Mm-hmm.
That was how you got a job.
Mm-hmm.
And we were almost never wrong. Those people were great at their job.
Hmm.
And I would like to argue that that is what math is for.
Is that iterative approach to solving those problems?
Yes, and realizing it's not about gas stations. It's a concept.
Yes. Yes, and thinking bigger beyond the question. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, that makes sense. It makes a lot of sense. I'd like to think a little bit about the things that hold us back from thinking big. I think we have this universal desire to fit in, to be mediocre, to dampen the brightness that makes us who we are. We search for belonging at all costs, and it's reinforced in clothing stores, in the marketing messages that we encounter every day, and of course, most of all, in schools. I think of your example there, and probably the reason I'm guessing some of those people took notes is because taking the risk of becoming the leader or being wrong is really so scary that it prevents people from doing that. Can you speak to that innate need to fit in and how we can go beyond that?
I'd be delighted. So there are two reasons it happens. The first reason is evolution. You didn't end up on the face of the earth in the year 2018 because your genes 10,000 generations ago worked out that you were the outspoken one, the one who always was on the edge of the village, the one who was in the jungle by yourself. Because if you were that person, a saber-toothed tiger ate you and you didn't have any grandchildren.
Right.
That we know that almost every species evolves towards safety, because safety away from predators is the single best way to survive. Okay, got that. But then about 100 years ago, we added to it the fact that industrialists with their new fancy factories, needed two things. As I've mentioned, they needed compliant factory workers who would do what they were told, which was a big shift from farming. And number two, they needed compliant customers who would buy a lot of stuff, hoping that it would help them fit in and be popular. Mm-hmm. Because remember, in 1895, the average Canadian owned two pairs of pants and two pairs of shoes. That was it. Hmm. And we had to create a cultural dynamic of consumption to fit in. Not consumption to stand out, but consumption to fit in. Mm-hmm. And so we keep reinforcing that. Marketers spend trillions of dollars trying to persuade us that we will die alone, shamed, lonely, if we don't buy enough stuff.
Yes.
And so, of course, we reflect that in so many of the things that we do. And we look at the Elon Musks or the Sheryl Sandbergs of the world and we say, well, they're an outlier. They're some sort of genius. Mm-hmm. Well, not at all. They just didn't get the memo about sitting quietly in the corner and taking notes.
Right. Right. Yeah. And I think you're right about that piece that we do. We have a really fixed perspective of who these quote unquote successful people are, that it is somehow written into their genes. And I think this has been one of the most fundamental changes in my own mindset, is that I'm starting to see patterns with people who have done really incredible things. These are people who have taken risks. These are people who have failed multiple times, but have found resilience and that ability to get back up and stay on target and keep trying and not give up. And that, I think, is also part of my job as an educator, is to build that resilience to help students to rewrite whatever personal narratives they're creating about their own ability to succeed in this world or to achieve the dreams that they may have for themselves. So what do you think, or how do you think it's important that we as educators help students realize that they are the authors of their own personal narratives, that they can write the ends to their stories, and that they're not held, they don't need to be held down by their personal experiences through trauma or adverse child experiences or even their middle class home life? Because I think sometimes people think, well, you know, nothing very interesting has happened to me, but that somehow holds people back too. You recently shared your own personal origin story on your Akimbo podcast about some of the adversity that you'd experienced as a youth. And it really made me think about that powerful impact that we can have on our students when we reinforce that they can write their own endings.
Well, it helps if they have a teacher like you. That's 80% of it, is someone who's willing to push against the system of compliance and take what feels like a risk, but isn't a risk at all, of challenging students to become who they want to become. And then the second step is to realize the urgency of this. In Stop Stealing Dreams, I wrote about a book that a guy did some research on, I can't remember his name, where he did a really significant statistical study in Rochester, New York, of teenagers and what they wanted to be when they grew up. And he gave them some choices. And the choices included president of a major university, head of a Fortune 500 company, a U.S. senator, etc. And the fourth choice was assistant to a Hollywood celebrity. And by far, that was the number one choice.
Wow.
And for me, the pathos, the really scary part is the assistant part. Mm. That's bad enough you want to be a celebrity, but to be an assistant, the coffee boy, the doer of chores, well, that's because it's safe. It's because someone's going to tell you what to do. Mm-hmm. And I think the solution is actually very straightforward, not expensive, but challenging to the system. Mm-hmm. And the solution is to spend 1 to 4 hours a day having your kids solve interesting problems and lead. Mm-hmm. So that includes editing Wikipedia, writing a blog every day, doing spoken word poetry, figuring out how to repeatedly make ever better videos that teach people something that you know that they don't, putting together fundraisers, organizing one entity or another that makes a change happen. There, if someone said, we're going to get rid of all the English classes in school, there would be an outcry. Mm-hmm. But we got rid of all the leadership classes. Hmm. Why did we do that? Right? So the idea that we can say to a kid who's 8, you're going to blog every day. And I'm not going to worry about privacy because I'm going to have you do it under another name. Every day for the next 10 years, you're going to write something on your blog, a story, a piece of advice, something that you learned. Hmm. Go. Well, guess what? Within a year or two, that person's not going to view that act as traumatic. They're going to view the act of speaking their mind with original thoughts as normal. Mm-hmm. And there's nothing holding us back from doing that except for the status quo.
Right. Right. And I think about this idea, I think people would go, a blog every day? Are you kidding? So, you know, there's this idea that how on earth could you ever come up with a topic every day? And as teachers, I think we have a tremendous influence on the way that students see themselves as creators. And I know that you have a particular position on the notion of writer's block, and that I find that fascinating. What's your take on writer's block and how this might apply to the daily practice of someone hoping to inspire her students to express themselves? And I think that's what you're getting at, is how do you get to the core of what you believe in? And there's so many different ways of expressing that, but how do you whittle it down to the core of your message as a human being, right?
Well, there's no such thing as writer's block. Right? You have this wonderful podcast. You didn't have a podcast a year ago. Where did it come from? Did you have podcaster's block?
No.
No, you simply showed up as a professional. Plumbers don't get plumber's block. Jugglers don't get juggling block. Writers pretend they get writer's block because they're afraid. Mm. But the solution to I don't have anything to write is to write poorly. Mm. That the people who say they have writer's block are really saying, I don't have the ability to write polished professional work my first try. Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, I know. No one does. So do bad writing. Do more bad writing. If you do enough bad writing, you will have good writing. But you don't have writer's block. What you have is an insufficient amount of practice on the road to good writing.
And I think that in itself has changed the way I've approached my own blogging practice, even my own writing practice, and my willingness to do that, as Brené Brown says, that shitty first draft, and be okay with it, that that's not all of me. This is just a piece of me, and this is an iteration toward that overall goal. And it's a powerful thing to realize, I think. And I think it's a very, very important one to teach students and to get them beyond this idea that you either have it or you don't. And this idea that when we do get there, we're going to get picked. So you've written in your Stop Stealing Dreams manifesto that settling for the not particularly uplifting dream of a boring, steady job isn't helpful, but being picked to be lucky isn't helpful either. What is it with our culture's obsession of getting picked? Why do you think that we have this universal pull for fame, external acceptance, and significance?
Well, there's always been this desire to become royalty, Cinderella and the slipper, and all of that nonsense that was put upon the culture by the people at the top to justify the fact that they get all the fancy desserts. That it's, oh, anyone can do this, but you've got to get picked, and then you can also have the fancy desserts. One, you keep the cycle going. If you run an institution like a university, oh, well, you can come to my fancy university, but first I have to pick you, then you have more power. Mm. If you run a book publishing company, you say, well, anyone can write a book, but first we have to pick you, you have more power. So it's not a surprise that individuals and organizations in power want to push forward the idea that you must be picked. But what the internet has done for so many kinds of work is said, you can pick yourself. So Jeffrey Katzenberg and Steven Spielberg don't get to pick who's going to be the next big director. You can just take your phone, make a movie, put it on YouTube, see if it spreads. Mm-hmm. Right? So when Psy made Gangnam Style, which was seen by more than 2 billion times, mm-hmm. my understanding is he didn't do it with a big contract from Rick Rubin or Sony Records. Mm-hmm. He did it from South Korea. Mm-hmm. Pick yourself. So when we're talking about leadership and writing and music and video and math and programming, these are all things where you don't have to pick, get picked anymore, mm-hmm. right? You still need to get picked to be a Dallas Cowboys cheerleader, but that's yet another reason to not want to be a Dallas Cowboys cheerleader.
Yes, and to pick yourself. I want to switch gears a little bit, and I want to talk about this concept of feedback. As educators, which I know you're not a fan of the word, but as educators, we are charged with giving advice and critical feedback in such a way that we hopefully can empower our students to improve upon their skills, for example, in writing or in numeracy or in reading, whatever it may be. It has the potential to be a shame-filled practice. And I know that there are countless people. I think Brené Brown has quoted, I think around 85% of adults that she interviewed can remember a shaming incident. And likely it was probably related to feedback that he or she received from an educator. How can we give meaningful assessment and feedback to our students in such a way that we don't cut them off at the knees, that we don't deflate their excitement about something? What's the key to giving good feedback?
Well, I think I'd start with calling it advice instead.
Sure.
Because usually when someone says, I'm about to give you some feedback, we're already in a hole. The second thing I would say is, because we have seen what perfect looks like ever more clearly, right? We've read Pulitzer Prize winning books. We've watched the video of the moment. And then an 8-year-old or a 12-year-old shows us their work. Our temptation is to compare it to perfect. Hmm. But that's foolish, because this person isn't going to become a Pulitzer Prize winning writer, isn't going to perform at Carnegie Hall. So that kind of feedback isn't going to help us. What's going to help us is understanding who it's for and what's it for. Is this helping them get on the road to where they want to go? Mm. Are we giving them advice about their effort, or are we giving them advice about their performance? Because those are two different things. So if someone says, here, I wrote this, and it's sloppy, and it took them a minute, an appropriate piece of advice is, first, gain enrollment, which is, are you hoping to create something you're proud of? Because if the answer to that is no, then you have some teaching to do about why we want in the first place to make something we're proud of. Because if you haven't sold that idea, nothing else is going to help. Mm-hmm. And then the second idea is, all right, well, I think you could be more proud of it if you wrote more drafts, if you put the effort in to show that you'd really thought it through. What would that look like? So I haven't told you your work is lousy. I haven't told you that you're lousy. What I've said is, if your goal is to have an impact, learning to put more effort in is a life skill. Mm-hmm. So if I can start that cycle, now I can coach this person, because now this person is committed to the journey. I didn't get them to commit to the journey by criticizing their work. I got them to commit to the journey by selling them on why the journey is worth being committed to. Mm-hmm. That's missed by 90% of all the teachers. They just go straight for the shortcut of, don't you want an A?
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
Well, actually, no, I don't want an A. I just want my parents to leave me alone. Those are two totally different things.
Yes.
Right? And so that means if you've got parents that are leaving the kid alone and don't care about whether they get an A or not, and all the teacher is offering is an A.
Yeah.
You've failed as a teacher, mm-hmm. because for the rest of that kid's life, they're going to be in a compliance mindset and a minimalist mindset. How little can I get away with?
Yes. And we see that all the time.
Right. What would happen if you could teach them from a young age that to ask the question, how much can I produce? How much difference can I make? Mm-hmm. Why don't we just teach that for 5 years in a row? Because if we could teach just that, the kids would figure the rest out.
Yeah.
And I know that you were, you know, that you were part of the podcasting fellowship. And, you know, we teach the marketing seminar. 6,000 people have been through it. We teach the Alt MBA. Thousands of people in 40 countries have been through it. And what we find is the people who show up are asking, how much can I do? Mm-hmm. Because they never ask, will this be on the test? Because we don't have a test. And they never ask, how do I get an A? Because we don't give A's. And there is no certification. So because we start with enrollment of the right people for the right reason, looking for the right thing, everything else goes 100 times better. And we get all this credit for it, for a 97% completion rate and the Alt MBA and everything else. We don't deserve the credit except for the fact that we have the discipline to create an environment where everyone's going where we're going.
And the generosity there, I think that's the piece when I was doing the fellowship that surprised me so much. People really caring about the work that you did to the point of being able to provide really meaningful advice. And for me, I think putting my ego aside so that it wasn't about me as a person, but it was about engaging with them and that advice to create a better product, to create something that was better than I ever would have imagined. And I could not have done that by myself. And I think that's the piece too, this connection network piece that we really need to be teaching our students to. It's not just about individuality. It's important to be an individual, but it's incredibly powerful to work with someone else who really cares about you and what you're putting out there. And that's really what I learned in the fellowship.
That's right. That having someone with a gentle hand on your back instead of slapping you in the face changes everything.
It does.
But most teachers, because they're under pressure from the system, find themselves not wanting to, but doing it, slapping kids in the face because they need compliance, because the system is based on compliance.
Yeah. Before we move on to the two questions I have for you, is there anything that you'd like to touch on that you haven't had a chance to do so?
I'm not sure if I'm supposed to say this during the podcast itself, but you're really good at this and I'm thrilled to be talking to you.
Oh man, thank you. I can't tell you how much that means to me. Thank you for saying that. Thank you. What does kindness mean to you?
I guess I'd say kindness has two elements. There's kindness in the moment that says, if you can avoid the sharp barbs and the difficult interactions with people and still be the contributor you want to be, that posture of kindness is always the best path. Mm-hmm. And the second half of it, I would say, is that in the longer run, the kind thing to do is discover where someone wants to head and do the difficult work of either helping them get there by giving them useful and thoughtful advice, or helping them see that that's probably not where they want to go and helping them learn why. Hmm. And both of those things are difficult to do, but if you do them well, they ultimately are one of the kindest things you can do for people.
Hmm. What one message would you print on one of those quote cups that would be sold in bookstores across the world?
So I sort of have an Instagram, but I haven't used it in a really long time. And the reason is because Instagram is the quote cup of the digital world.
Yes.
I love bookstores. So I'm afraid I'm going to have to give you a shortcut answer. And I think it would say, stop buying mugs and buy another book.
I love it. This has been incredible. Thank you so much for taking the time to speak to me today. It means the world to me. And I think my whole outlook on education is different because of you. And I thank you for that.
Wow. That means a lot. And the ruckus you're making means a lot. And I'm speaking on behalf of your students when I say thank you.
I want to thank you for the wonderful reviews that you've left for this podcast on iTunes. Your reviews make a big difference in helping other educators find this show. If you think that I'm doing good work here and you'd like others to get inspired and join our 21-day kindness challenge and movement, I'd love it if you would take a minute, head over to iTunes and leave a review. Thank you so much. This has been another episode of Kindsight 101, the podcast. For links to resources mentioned in this episode, visit smallactbigimpact.com and click on our podcast and choose this episode number. Now, I'd love to give my audience a heads up about my new book, which will provide ideas, actionable strategies, and inquiry-based approaches to creating kinder classroom through serving the community. Subscribe to my blog for more information. Now, I would love to hear from you. What's the biggest insight that you gain from this conversation? Head over to our website, smallactbigimpact.com, leave a comment on our podcast page, or tag and connect with us on social media with the hashtag #SmallActBigImpact to share your inspiring story of kindness. Can't wait to hear from you.